No. Look after.
No.
He's heard about us. He's not. He's just said a word.
He's heard about us. He's changed his mind.
Coming in the 8th week.
So next week?
No. This is the 6th week.
Eighth week.
So this is week 6. If you look on your unit outline, today is week 6, 13th of September. And it's David Malouf's Remembering Babylon. We're going to be talking about it. Next week is David Malouf Remembering Babylon. We're going to be talking about it. The week after that is the vacation week. And in that week, we're going to go to the art gallery.
Yeah.
And we're going to have to sort out with Rosanna and Emma. But I think we're going to meet at the gallery at 3 o'clock. I think that's the plan because the gallery stays open on a Wednesday night. So if you wanted to stay there a bit longer, we could maybe, you know, if the weather's nice, we could have a picnic or something in the domain outside the gallery when we finish our walk and talk around. I'm going to take you around and show you paintings that are related to the literature we're studying, and I'm going to try and show you how understanding something about painting also helps us to understand something about literature. That's the point of going there. That's the point. And the following week, week 8, David Malouf's visiting us. So we will, week 8, that's on the 4th of, that's the week of the, week of the, start, the week starting the 4th of October. So I think it's the 6th of October, or is it the, I haven't got my calendar to hand. I think it's either the 4th or the 6th of October in that week. It's coming on the Wednesday afternoon. And by that time, we will have had 2 weeks on Remembering Babylon, plus a week off at the gallery to finish off reading and understanding. And I hope you will get a question or two, write a question or two that you want to ask David Malouf, and that'll start our discussion going. That's the way it's going to flow. And after that, we go on to Shakespeare's The Merchant of Venice. Moving towards a performance, and we get the Bell Shakespeare educators coming in here, going to work with us for a session, and then we go and see the play in the Opera House. All the tickets have been got for that, so it's an interesting way we're going to move forward.
And then when do we do that performance?
The performance happens in week 12, rehearsal and performance of scenes from The Merchant of Venice, week 12. That's the beginning of November. Hi, Ray.
Do we do it here?
I have to work that out. It might be here, or it might be somewhere else in Sydney. That detail has to be worked out.
So we don't perform it, do we?
Yes, you do.
Yeah.
You perform it. A part of it, a little part of it, like about a 20-minute segment. So just a little bit.
Where do we perform?
Well, maybe here or maybe in the Aquinas Academy. Put your name down here, thanks, and pass it around.
There's a Darlinghurst Theatre.
Yeah, that's right, I know. My son has performed there. The Darlo, yeah. I know it well. Yes, Josh.
Is week 12 the last week or is it week 14?
No, week 12 is the last week of teaching. And your final take-home exam, which you have to submit for passing the course, that comes in a fortnight later on the 15th of November.
Okay.
So when the course finishes, you've got 2 weeks to finish off the work.
So we received that on the 15th of November?
Or you have to hand it in on the 15th of November. You'll receive it before, you know, well before week 12.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so first of all, I want to have a little look at your blogs.
Because
there's some really good stuff here to have a look at. So let's go and have a look at Neil's first. I'm not going to spend a great deal of time on this because we want to get to Remembering Babylon fairly soon. But it's worthwhile just looking at how some of you have understood the prose that we've been doing. Here is Neil. I've dwelt and contemplated about the story. Can you all see? Am I blocking anybody's view?
Yeah.
It's all right. I've dwelt and contemplated about the story every day used, written by the author Alice Walker. The mostly narrated story by the character's mama reveals to us her thoughts about all other characters in this story. In this I found there to be literal logic. Meaning and feelings are portrayed throughout the story, much the same as in our own life stories. The character D, narrated by Mama's point of view, remembers D as a child, how she wanted nothing more than to somewhat belittle. How she wanted more than to somewhat belittle her mother and little sister, also to escape her culture and ancestry. As on the other hand, D in character does not show this view. She remembers the butter churn, bench tops and the quilts, how they were made and by whom, the care that was taken in the making of these items. D wanted to put them all on display to show and to embrace her ancestry. She even changed her name. That's as much as I'll read there of that, but I just want to show you the comment that was made, because comment's important for working with your learning partner. I'd like you all to take my suggestions to your blog and take these further with your learning partner, because I can only do so much in terms of correcting and so on. But this is what I said about Neil. Neil, you show a really good understanding of this essentials of this story. Well done. There are a few things that need to be fixed up in your punctuation and sentence structure. For example, all other characters with apostrophe S should be all other characters with no apostrophe S, because in this instance, characters is simply plural and doesn't mean ownership. Notice that when you say mama's point of view, the apostrophe S is perfectly right, because here you are talking about the point of view that's owned by mama. So that's when you use an apostrophe S. My students at uni still get this wrong, so don't feel embarrassed about getting this wrong. But, you know, that the rule is usually that with a singular ownership, this bike is owned by the boy, the boy's bike. If you're talking about plural, the boys, a number of them, you know it's plural because it's got bikes there. The apostrophe goes after the S. So that's ownership again. Now, if there's no ownership, if it's just a plural, like the boys did this, there's no ownership there. It's just the boys doing something. It's not about the boys' bike. There's no apostrophe S there. I get some students, even at third year uni, every time they see an S, wherever there's an S in their essay, immediately, apostrophe, apostrophe, apostrophe. Makes a nonsense of it. Everywhere that S, or they leave it out altogether. So there are simple rules there with apostrophes. And there are some exceptions. For instance, if I say, the woman's hat, then it's apostrophe before the S because it's one woman, the woman's hat. But watch what happens here. If you say the women's hat, where do you think the apostrophe should go?
After the S.
You think it would go after the S because it's plural. But in this case, you'll notice that the word itself changes its plurality here. It goes before, because this already shows its plurality in the change of the word forms. That's a confusing thing. That's a confusing thing.
Wouldn't it be the women's hats?
It would be. It would be, unless they all share the same hat. Thanks, Colin.
So, Michael, can you tell us who making these rules?
Oh, these rules are created in the 18th century. And there,
one person or
no,
or
not one person.
It comes.
Yeah, it comes. Yes, Josh.
Well, that's no wonder. I always knew this, but no wonder the English language is the most difficult language.
It's very difficult for foreigners to learn. That's right. And you know, there are other sort of oddities that you come up against. For instance, you talk about the cat, the cat's dinner. The cat's dinner. The dinner is owned by the cat. That's right, apostrophe S, owned by the cats. And then you say...
Cat as a person. It's come in.
The dinner is in its bowl. Now, it, of course, is a pronoun standing in place of a noun. It
is.
But you'd think that... that should have an apostrophe S because it's also ownership. It's apostrophe. But it apostrophe S actually means it is. So you can't put the apostrophe there in that instance. So that confuses a lot of people.
That's same as his or hers, isn't it?
It's his or hers. That's
yes.
Right. You're referring to the cat as a kind of a neutral.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's your favourite cat and you know it's a lady, you'd call it her. But we're just talking about cats in general there. Punctuation is a tricky issue, and you'll certainly deal with that when you're at university. I mean, you know, there are rules about particularly semicolons and colons that people get very confused about. This is a colon, and a colon usually points out a list of things that come and a semicolon actually divides two separate closely related sentences.
So the semicolon is like a little bracket for each word, is that right? Little slash?
This is a semicolon.
Yeah, I know. But is the semicolon the same as like a...
A bracket?
Like a bracket.
No, it's not like a bracket. Not like a bracket. Not like a parenthesis.
So what's the difference between a semicolon and a bracket?
A bracket is when you are separating an idea out, for instance.
So you've got two ideas at once, but you're...
That's right.
It hasn't been made clear what the idea is, so then you put your brackets and make it...
That's
clear
it.
Do I find most two very confusing, the semicolon and the bracket?
So you could have something like the man went to the cinema, and in brackets, the man who lived in Beecroft.
Not a bracket, but as in like a...
That's a bracket, man.
No.
That's
no.
A bracket.
No, not a bracket.
Yep.
We're talking about...
Square. You mean the one with the arrow?
No.
The home sign.
Fish. Slash. Talking about that thing.
A hyphen.
A chicken. Yeah, hyphen.
Hyphen.
Yeah, I get confused with a hyphen and that. What's the difference between those two?
Well, very different. The hyphen joins two parts of a word, like
she's
for instance.
Younger, so we can
all see.
Yeah. So, what was the example you just gave there?
Like fish, hyphen, chicken, hyphen,
comma.
Okay. Like a list of things that you get in a restaurant.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or something,
just
as an example.
Well, it'd
be a comma, couldn't it?
You could actually use a semicolon there in that list, in that listing. You could also use a comma there. But this is usually used between two sentences, almost like a full stop. Okay.
Full stop with a carry-on, isn't it?
It's a full stop with a carry-on. Well done.
Looks
see?
Like Jamie.
You know your punctuation rules very well, Neil.
Well, I don't. Well, obviously.
So can you put in that as well as a hyphen or all?
Hyphen is joining two closely connected words, like for instance.
You can't hyphenate the whole lot, so get away from commas.
Hyphen is something like that, garden party. Garden party, two words that are closely connected.
Yeah.
So that's a hyphen.
Hyphen is another word for a hyphen is a dash.
What about just a comma
or a semicolon.
Alright, I actually did that without the dot at the top though.
That's right, that's a comma.
Okay.
And
that's still my dot.
Who makes these rules?
How they come? It's a group of people.
No, it's not a group.
Said you follow me. It's linguists and grammarians.
Linguists and grammarians.
Spoken English go around through the Americas and through the Pacific.
England, India, the Euro nations
and the Americas had to come up with a unified language that everybody could understand. So they took some of English and they took some of the Americas and some of the ancient Latin and they put it all together, and that's how we have modern day English, which is worldwide.
Is that right?
I'll just ask a question. Is any person responsible?
No, no single person.
It's going to be random. Say, Neil decide comma, I decide this one.
Yeah.
Hey, how it's all come?
There are books called The Rules of English Grammar, and some of them are very out of date.
Don't do that, but some of them are out of date.
And there's all new theories come in all the time about English grammar.
Theories.
Yeah.
Just one question. Is it better to do a semicolon rather than a comma?
No, equal. Depends on the context. And okay. when you do your essay, I'll correct it, and you gradually will find out.
I'm learning about apostrophes big time.
Yes, Scott.
This book, The Rules of English Grammar, well, we can Google that and get a basic to do our stuff as well.
Yeah, you can.
Yeah,
there's lots of books like that, yeah.
It's not basic.
And in fact...
After the beginner's one.
It's pretty crap.
Yeah, in fact, can I alert you to something that's on your website on Leo?
Yeah, but you can only get it checked, and I only give you this piece of paper like I got that first time, remember?
Let me just take you to Leo here, because this is important.
Yeah. I've done a grammar check and it gave me this thing and it told me what was wrong with what I'd written. Here it is. My grammar, I had one incorrect noun number, I had one punctuation in compound complex sentences, I had three spelling confused words, I had two enhancements, which are two word choices, and style, I had four, which is free and proper formatting, and one passive voice misuse. That's what grammar does. Let me check it.
So you just
copy it and then you send it, like you can do it on Leo and you get a check, you just check it. And it will show you, but it won't give you the answers.
It just points out the mistakes.
Just points out your mistakes. You've got to find, you go to ask your learning partner about, look, this is what I've got from your grammar check. And show me what my mistakes are. Yeah. Otherwise, you can, but you've got to pay for it. And it's an American one too, so your words come back different.
Just on the screen.
Michael.
That's something he's going to show us now.
I'm just going to show you something. We're in Leo. We're in your Leo Exploring Literature site. And if you come down here, it says useful resources in the middle, and you go here to academic writing skills and academic skills unit, academic writing skills.
We can't get that on the computers here.
Yes, you can.
That one's done, it says it's space blocked.
Well, that's it, it's not found here. Why is that?
Because you can't get it in this system, the server here won't let you have it. Not that you have that one either, I tried. Unless you have OE devices, but that's only because you copied it.
I don't know what's happened there.
Yeah. So I tried the other day and I couldn't get it. That's why I don't think that when you post your blog...
I'm glad I had to look for it. I'll have to check that and see what I can do. I might be able to put a link through WordPress, in fact, for it. So I'll look on that and keep your eyes out. But there is, in ACU, there is a grammar site with all punctuation and nicely summarized, which our students use on campus. So I'll see if I can get that working for you. Okay.
Michael.
Yes.
Just a random question that popped into my head just now.
Yep.
Is it true that universities now, are we eventually going into a direction of back into Shakespeare language again?
No.
At university?
No, we're not.
Somebody was telling me
that. Forward, no.
Definitely not. Definitely not. We'll have a talk about that when we look at Shakespeare in a few weeks' time.
So we're not going back to Shakespeare language?
No, we're definitely not going back to Shakespeare language. Definitely not.
Okay.
That's a complete miss. Now, you'll notice on the blog that I've got here in week 5 that I've put all your blog addresses there, except I haven't got Scott's there. So I want to put Scott's there as well. So if you go here, you can find each other easily there just by clicking. So I clicked on...
I clicked on Neil. No, I tried to look today. Yeah.
There's Josh.
The ones that had the envelope on it.
There's Josh, look. There he is. Josh hasn't got anything in today, so we'll bypass Josh. Ray has got something in there, look. Ray's got a very interesting entry on everyday use. He says here, everyday use is a story about heritage and family relationships spoken by my mother. I'll just make it a bit bigger. Daughter come to see mother and sister after a long time, but instead of share love and affection to family members, she make a big drama about two quilts. Now, Ray understands the story really well, but he needs help with his grammar. I mean, like my grandfather, who's of European descent, it's very hard to know when you use the articles, etc. So what I've done here, I've actually translated Ray's sentence there. Hello, Ray. You understand the key elements of this story well, but really good now to allow your learning partner to help you smooth out your excellence insights into more academic English. For example, daughter come to see mother and sister after a long time, but instead of share love and affection to family members, she make a big drama about two quilts. That equals the daughter comes to see her mother and sister after a long time, but instead of sharing love and affection with family members, she makes a big drama about two quilts. there's little tiny changes and it becomes perfect English. So your idea is really good, a good summary, but you need to sit down with your learning partner at 5 o'clock, 5:30, and go through this. This is the way you're going to learn. And the best thing is not simply to get your learning partner to rewrite it for you, because if they just rewrite it for you, you're not going to learn. You need to get some help from them as to why you put the and at and sisters, and why you don't have a full stop at the end of that. And you know, you've got she make a big drama about two quilts. It more sense to make that as part of the sentence, part of the one sentence. So that's that. Okay, who else? Let's have a look.
Ryan, but he's not here. He should be around.
So we've got Ray, we've got Ronan's not here, we can pass Ronan. Adelaide, you haven't got anything this... I'm desperate for the next episode of that rather steamy story you started last week.
Oh, but it might get a bit too...
It might.
But I can't go too... I don't know where
I'm at.
Well, you could change your subject if you really want to. You could go to some cool topic. Something very cool and benign, like looking over Bondi Beach or something like that.
Why don't you turn around and make it into a gaming hotel, BGH, and you'll have to talk about it openly? Man, a woman can't talk about their appropriate achievements.
And then we're going to go to Song. Now, Song had a beautiful entry here, drawing on Alice Walker's everyday use. Explain why you think Dee or Mama value their heritage the most. The narrator Mama describes that she herself represents the indigenous spirit. She sees her two daughters as the confrontation of different values. Very good. And then I like particularly the way that Song makes his observation and then backs that up with a direct quote from the story. This is what you're going to have to do in your essay on Remembering Babylon. You have to make a statement and back it up with good quotations from the text. And in fact, the best way to write a literature essay is to keep close to the text all the time, not to go off on some kind of grand theory, but keep focused on the text and use the text as the basis for your argument, as Song has done here. The family's everyday used property that comes down to this generation is the transmitted symbol of spiritual heritage, and so on. So, quite a long good entry here. But I've said to Song, pretty well similar to what I've said to Neil and others, Song, this shows a really interesting exploration into the deeper currents of this story. I love the way you're looking very hard at Dee's contribution. It is known that Alice Walker herself said that there is a part of herself in each of these characters, Maggie, Dee and Mama. That's, I don't know if we talked about that last week, but I actually taught this story to my students on campus who are doing American literature. And in studying for my lecture this week, I found, and I don't know if I had this in my head before I talked to you, that Alice Walker said that Dee, Maggie and Mama were all her. And, you know, when you read that statement, it's a show...
Right at the beginning of the story.
Yeah.
It's half the garden.
That's right. So it makes you wonder about our reactions to Dee. Is Dee really as bad as we thought she was?
No.
Does Alice Walker have some part of Dee that she believes in or thinks that Dee's got some perspective that's worth acknowledging? But Song really got onto this. So I then say to Song, there are a few expression issues that need correcting, and I suggest that you go over your writing here carefully with your learning partner. For example, Dee was merely hates their indigent circumstance. So Dee hates her indigenous circumstance, but I'm not exactly sure if it's what you meant. So sometimes when I'm marking an essay, there's an expression and I'm not really sure whether my correction is exactly what you meant, because indigent is a word which means somebody who's poverty-stricken. But did you mean indigent or did you mean indigenous? So work that out with your learning partner. Sit down with your learning partner and go over this, because that will help you get clarified about your own thoughts. Here's an example of a semicolon that is wrongly placed. D sees value as semicolon nice things. So the semicolon there is like a block in the road. I say it's like a brick in the road. I tell my students sometimes that if you put a semicolon in the middle of the sentence like that, it stops the thought. D sees values as... A colon could be used there. A colon kind of is like an equal sign. But better still leave punctuation out there altogether. It's not needed. These are minor details. And then you've got the last point, she'd rather throw her inherited name away. Well, this is a good example of the terribly complex aspect of the English language, which makes anybody like Song or like Ray, who've got 10 languages to their armory, not know how to use it, because through, you know, what's the difference? How can through be spelt T-H-R-O-U-G-H? A German would say, I pronounce that Tehara-Uguha, Tehara-Uguha, which is the phonetic pronunciation of English through. Throw. So it's a spelling error caused by a lack of familiarity with the English language. Okay, so what else have we got here? Let's go back. Lastly, we've got Yvette. Now, I don't think you had a further take on there, did you, Yvette?
No, I got a
Google teacher wasn't there last year. Okay, so you've got your three blogs up there. Oh, I did get yours. Where is it? Oh, hang on a second. I did get it. Rima, there it is. Yeah, Rima. Rima, yours was outstanding. I won't read it all, but Rima's got a beautiful description of why you think Dee and Mama value their heritage the most. Everyday use is such a story of depth with a message of grand importance delivered through all the characters, especially Maggie, that it would be a great injustice and a misunderstanding on the reader's part if she is not mentioned in the title. Question. All three characters value their heritage from different perspectives. Mama's and Maggie's evaluation is based on their sincerity and reverence. Dee, on the other hand, having willfully stepped out of every aspect of her heritage, contemptuously turning her back to it, sees the value of her heritage through westernized eyes with no feel for the heartbeats of those who have authentically lived their heritage. Dee is a traitor who has exchanged the irreplaceable valuables of her heritage for the glittering trinkets of the New Age. You write beautifully. You really write well. You've got a great grasp of the story there. I won't read it all. It's quite long, but I've written one comment here. And what did I say? I said, this is an excellent summary of the key elements in the story, and it was really good to see you placing so much emphasis on Maggie. Well done. There is one important question, however, that hinges on Alice Walker's own comments on this story, and that is that she, Alice Walker, has said that she has a part of herself in each of the characters in this story, Maggie, Mama, and Dee. I wonder whether there is any evidence in this story that Alice Walker has any kind of sneaking sympathy with Dee. So that's a broader question.
The mere fact that she's her sister is part of her, isn't it?
That's part of it, that's right. Yeah. So it's a question of whether within the story as we read it, whether there is any sense that maybe Dee's belief in tradition as being something that should be preserved historically has as much value as a belief in tradition that wants to keep using it. There's a question there. I don't think we resolved the question, and it's a big question. I'm sure that, you know, Dee and Maggie would, or Dee and Mama would still be arguing it out. What is the validity there? Okay, so let's turn now to our friend David Maloof and Remembering Babylon. And what you've got there is actually the cover of the first edition of Remembering Babylon, which has got Jemmy Fairley standing on the fence, half white, half black, symbolic of his kind of dual presence in the novel as someone who kind of is a bridge between indigenous and European peoples. And as I say, this is a story about the importance of the outsider. And I think that David Maloof in this story was not only reflecting the way that colonial Australians couldn't deal with anything that was outside their frame of reference, because the story is about a little colonial outpost in the mid-19th century that have to deal with the arrival of this stranger in their community. So Maloof was interested in that. But he was also interested, and this is part of his take on the story, that this stranger would bring to some people in this community something of real value. And I think that David Maloof really believes this. I think David Maloof believes that people who are outside the norm have got something really important to contribute. Here are two blog topics for you for this week, which Neil has already told me sound too much the same as each other. First impressions of remembering Babylon. Either write 100 words that capture your first thoughts about this novel. That might be a kind of a kick-in start to your essay writing. Or describe in your own 100 words any one of the characters in the novel. So this is an exercise in writing skills, in trying to write accurately, getting your learning partner to help you with that.
So this is for this week?
That's for this coming week. That's correct.
Oh, is that putting on a blog? Is that putting on
yes.
a blog topic? That's what it says up there.
Blog topic. And it's already in my blog, so you can read it there. You don't need to write it down now, Adelaide.
Yeah, okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
So there is David Malouf. He will look like that when he's sitting here in this chair talking to you in 3 weeks' time. And how do I know David Malouf? He was an old teacher of mine at Sydney University. When I was a student there, he taught me Shakespearean drama. But I remember meeting him at the bus stop. I was, I think, in third year university. I was travelling, I was living at King's Cross at the time. And I remember him, my teacher, coming up to me, and he said to me, "And what are you going to do with your life when you finish here?" And I was a bit taken aback that my teacher would actually be interested in what I was going to do in my life. And I said to him, "Well, I'm actually thinking of going on and doing honours and doing postgraduate work." And he said, "Ah, I'm going the opposite way. I'm about to leave university. I want to finish this novel I'm writing, and I'm going to kiss university bye-bye." He was about, he must have been in his late 30s, early 40s then.
So he was writing Remembered in Babylon?
No, at that time he was writing An Imaginary Life. Good day, Ronan.
Imaginary Life.
He was writing An Imaginary Life.
And Babylon was not written, not yet.
Remembering Babylon was not written yet. Now this is back in about 1970, 1973. And An Imaginary Life became an international classic. It wasn't a bestseller because David Malouf writes for a certain niche market. It's not your average read on the bus, read on the train novel. It's written for a niche market of people who are interested in poetic use of language, are interested in history of one kind or another. An Imaginary Life was actually a fictional biography of the Roman poet Ovid, who was kicked out of Rome because he was an embarrassment to the emperor and spent the rest of his life on the steppes of Russia out there and met a child out there that had been brought up by animals, a feral child. And in his relationship with the feral child, Ovid really grows and discovers new things about himself, new things about poetry. So it's an amazing novel, An Imaginary Life.
And David Tarzan.
Sorry?
It sounds like Tarzan.
It's a little bit like Tarzan, but a kind of a more intellectually advanced kind of Tarzan.
Poetic,
more poetic. That's exactly right. Thank you, Ray. So you've heard about the Archibald Prize, and I'm working on this, but I haven't secured it yet. I'm trying to get the art gallery, when we go in a fortnight, to allow us to go into the Archibald Prize free.
Please.
I'm trying to do that because normally it costs about.
For the division.
Yeah. Otherwise, we can show our student card and get a concession.
Well, you can get a concession, but it's, even then, it's not that cheap. It's about $10.
Or 20th.
No, concession. I mean, normal price is about 15. Concession's about 12. But I'm working on it.
I think that's about right. $16, I think.
Yeah, I'm working on it. I want to get you to the Archibald Prize if I possibly can. Now, this was an Archibald Prize. Not a winner, but an Archibald Prize picture by Geoffrey Smart, one of Australia's modern artists, a friend of David Malouf's. Sorry?
He's passed away.
And this is Geoffrey Smart's picture of David Malouf. What's it telling us about David Malouf? Don't be rude.
Sucking up ideas.
Don't be rude. Sucking up ideas. That's a good idea. That's a good thought. What other thoughts come to mind?
What is it? What has he got there?
Rima, tell the class.
Tapping into the unconscious.
Tapping into the unconscious. What about that? Is that a good idea?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Tapping into the unconscious. Yeah. What else about him?
Very
Ordinary person, Scott, brilliant. That's a really good. It's a good observation. He's standing there in a workman's boiler suit, near a load of bloody trucks.
A fuel tank.
Like
he's stealing fuel.
He's lonely. Solitary.
I'd like to blend. Yep. So that's right.
And all this rainbow of colors, containers. So he's connected to the community.
Connected to the community and the colors.
All the colors are the colors of the rainbow.
Yep. Josh?
Are they shipping containers? They look like shipping.
They look like shipping containers on trucks.
On trucks.
Yeah.
What does that word say up there?
It says Ovidio.
What is that?
Well, it could be. I mean, I've just told you about the story about imaginary life, the biography of Ovid. So Ovidio, I'm not sure why he put the O on the end of it.
Maybe that's his best novel. He thinks that's the best thing he's ever written was Ovidio.
Ovidio.
I mean, what's it called?
An imaginary life.
Imaginary life. Maybe he's referring back to that context.
Jeffrey Smart might think that.
Russian language,
yes.
Ovid, the name, if it pronounced it Ovidio, could be his life or something about him.
Could be about his life, yeah. So what's the word in the Russian language, Scott?
I don't know.
You don't know?
But that's what I understand in the languages. Yeah. Sometimes that's how they... Because English is very different. So
that's right.
His name, Ovidio, is what he's doing or his life, maybe.
Yeah. But I like very much to bring together some of the things that have been said about, for instance, Rima said, sucking up ideas from the unconscious and in touch with deeper things and marry that with Scott's idea of the ordinariness of the man. That's exactly what this novel, Remembering Babylon, is about. It goes deep into the unconscious of the characters and their inner motivations, but it's about ordinary people in ordinary settings and about somebody specially ordinary who can't even speak English, Jemmy Fairley. So it's a funny kind of mixture of extraordinary and ordinary. That's the world of David Malouf in his language and in his subject matter. Who else had their hand up? Somebody? Yes, Josh?
Could that image be about his working life?
Could be about his working life. Like, tell us how you read that.
Like, it looks like he's in a working outfit.
A boiler suit, yeah.
A boiler suit, and there's trucks out there. So therefore, he must be in an industrial estate, and he's working in an industrial estate area. Maybe that was his life as an industrialist.
Well, he wasn't literally an industrialist. He was a writer and an academic.
Yeah,
but the thing about David Malouf, the fact that, for instance, he's quite happy to come here and sit here and come to my class, is he's really an ordinary bloke. And that's the most amazing thing about him. And he's been given international prizes, all sorts of awards around the world, and yet he's got his feet firmly on the ground and always had hands. He's a remarkable person for that reason.
Because it does look like it's an industrial setting.
It does look like it, but it's sort of metaphorically an industrial setting. Although, from another point of view, Remembering Babylon is set very much in a kind of a working class environment. Song.
Yeah, it's interesting. His culture, how he's standing.
That's a very good observation. Go, Song.
Yeah, where he looked at the best or another thing.
Yeah.
And the way he's standing is pretty much like very casual.
Yeah.
And then although he involves something on
in the
left hand.
Yeah.
It's not like we really getting deep and then too hard. So it's pretty much casual and then he looking at something not of his front by the back.
Yeah, yeah.
Looking at side somewhere that out of sight.
That's right.
That's interesting.
And his hand in his pocket as well, very casual, as you say, very casual.
So when you turn back on someone, it's like a trusting position.
Trusting position.
Yeah, like his trust.
Otherwise,
you come with somebody comfortably.
You're very interesting.
Yeah.
So what was Jeffrey?
Hang on a second. Colin first, and then you.
Well, it's not a traditional portrait. This is on the show with Buff.
Oh, what? Sorry.
It's not a traditional portrait.
No.
On the show with Buff. As a whole, rather like his whole life, rather than like his dignified expression.
You're good. Not a traditional portrait. Shows his whole life and interesting aspects of his expression. Neil. Jemmy Fairley.
No. Jeffrey Smart. What was written in context of that painting?
Oh, nothing. You're inventing it all.
Just said that at the actual price.
And it was finalist.
I think it was a finalist, but don't.
But not the winner.
Not the winner.
Finalist.
Yeah. There's got to be a context with that. It can't just be hemmed in those walls by Jeffrey Smith.
I wrote that.
Oh, did you?
Okay. I wrote that.
All right. I thought that was what came with the painting. Sorry.
No.
Josh. I think this image will be focused based on society in general.
Society in general. Yeah, that's a good thought. Ronan, have you got a thought?
I just thought it was interesting that the portrait with it from behind him, and maybe
that's right.
It says that, you know, he's always focused on something, focused on his work or on the community, or
that's right.
You know, rather than having a vain person that wants themselves to be
a
proper portrait.
That's good. Excuse me.